If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. The story of Edward VIII and Wallis Simpson is often painted as a great love story of the 20th century, the king making the ultimate sacrifice by abdicating the British throne to be with the woman he loved. But a new book by Andrew Lowney, exploring what happened in the years after the abdication, paints a very different picture of the couple's relationship. Putting the questions to Andrew was our acting digital editor, Eleanor Evans.
Andrew, thanks so much again for joining us on the History Extra podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here again.
And your latest book is Traitor King, The Duke and Duchess of Windsor in Exile. And you write that no book before has started after the abdication in 1936 and looked fully at what happened to the Windsors in their exile. And yours is an account that takes in the Windsors' actions through the Second World War and mid-century, right through to their later years. And before we get into what's such a fascinating book and account, I hoped we could start by reminding listeners of the events that led to the abdication crisis in 1936, and where readers will begin.
Yes, I mean, the book begins on the 10th of December 1936, when he gives his abdication broadcast. And this is really the culmination of a crisis over the last, since he came to become king in January 1936. He had been having an affair with Wallis Simpson since 1934. He'd met her in 1931. And he was determined to marry her. And the problem was that she'd been married before. In fact, she was married to someone else at this time. And the problem became even more acute when in October she got a divorce from her second husband, because he was head of the Church of England. He wasn't allowed, as head of the Church of England, who didn't approve of divorcees, to marry her. So he was being forced to make a choice between marrying the woman, having a morganatic marriage, giving up the throne. And he was sort of manoeuvred, I would say, by Baldwin and various other people, just because of the way he got the support from various communities, particularly the Dominions, to give up the throne. But I think Edward was, if he had to have a choice, he wanted to marry Wallis rather than to be king. And that rather suited the establishment, who were nervous about her and her loyalties, and indeed his own commitment to the job. So the crisis really came to a head in December 1936, when his younger brother Bertie basically stepped up to the plate and took over. And it's the only time in modern British history that a monarch has abdicated. And I think we still see the shockwaves to this day about a royal giving up his duty for his own personal desires.
If we can look at the Duke of Windsor and this sort of his initial feelings after he's made this decision. I feel it was very interesting to me how rejuvenated almost this decision seems to him, in stark contrast to many people around him.
Yes, I mean, that night when he makes the broadcast, he has dinner with other members of the royal family. They're all absolutely shattered and really nervous about what the future will hold. And he feels elated by the whole thing. And he drives down after the dinner. He drives down to Portsmouth, catches a boat, and goes into exile on the continent. He's got to be basically in a different country from Wallis while he waits for the decree absolute to come through on a divorce, and to wait for them to get married. But he feels initially a completely free man now from all the responsibilities that have been hanging over him. I mean, that soon changes. And within weeks, he's pestering his brother about a financial settlement. He is a very bad house guest. He's staying at a castle just outside Vienna, lent to him by the Rothschild family. I think he is very impatient to sort of move on with his life, and he can't until this decree absolute comes through, which it does in April, and he's able then to marry in June.
And in contrast to his sort of optimism for the future, what's known about how the Duchess of Windsor was feeling, Wallace was feeling at the stage?
Well, I think everyone perceives this as a great love story, and I think the tragedy is it wasn't. Here was a woman who enjoyed her flirtation with the Prince of Wales and then the King. She enjoyed being his mistress. She actually still enjoyed being with her husband, Anna Simpson. And I think it's clear from books being republished recently that she was still writing to him and still really half in love with him. But the problem was that Edward was so obsessed with her that he said he would kill himself if she didn't basically marry him. And so she was emotionally blackmailed into this marriage. And though she made the best of it, it was not what she wanted. She enjoyed the trappings, but she did not want to be tied to this boy man who was really very entitled and frankly, rather boring. And so it didn't start off very well. I mean, there's a story told by Gore Vidal, literally on the first day after they got married. She came to his bed, to the foot of his bed. They didn't seem to share a bed. Not Gore Vidal's bed, I should say, but the Duke's. And said, you know, what are we going to do with the rest of our lives? And I think the story I'm telling is really the aftermath of this great event and the sadness of this exile and this attempt really to fill pretty empty lives.
Right. Well, if we can delve into that a little more then, what is the expectation on the part of the Duke of Windsor, and what sort of role is he expecting to be created for himself, and what's the reality he comes up against there?
Well, I don't think he really thought it through. I think he thought that he was going to be treated like the younger brother of the King, and therefore, in terms of, for example, the financial settlement, I think thought that he could, in a sense, have all the benefits of royalty, the trappings. He, for example, wanted his wife to be called Her Royal Highness, which, of course, she wasn't given. And that he could somehow play some role, just the good bits, visiting, keep up, for example, his military connections as the Colonel of the Welsh Guards. He thought he would be able to come back to Britain. But it was made very clear to him by the royal family that he had let them all down, that Bertie basically needed to be given free rein to establish himself. He was quite a not very confident person. He didn't want to be overshadowed by his older brother, who did have a certain charisma and a certain popularity, and that he should basically keep out of Britain for several years. And there really was no job for a former king, and he would have to just make the best of it. And that was the problem, that all the way through his life, Edward kept asking for jobs, but there was no job really for a former king, particularly given his rather dodgy associates. I mean, he could have done work with charities or arts organisations. He perhaps could have had some sort of business career, though I think that would have been quite difficult. So it was very difficult to know what role he could fulfil. He didn't really want to do charitable roles. He wanted status, but he didn't really want to have to work for it.
Well, a very, very interesting part of your book, a theme of your book, is how you look at the views you mentioned, the very confronting views of Edward and Wallace. And you mentioned how he may well have been manoeuvred towards abdication due to some of these views. What is the evidence there for how he was regarding the sort of rise of Nazism and movements on the continent in the late 1930s?
Well, it had become very clear, even before he became king, that he was very sympathetic to Germany. He was 14th, 16th German. He spoke fluent German. His mother was a German princess. His sympathies, he loved strong leadership. I mean, he was very sympathetic to some of the Nazi dogma. And he had, even as king, been tried to interfere with politics, with the Anglo-German naval agreements, with the occupation of the Rhineland. He had tried to interfere and play things down. He was much more concerned with the threat of communism than he was with fascism. And he thought that the fascists would act as a bulwark against the communists, and that would save the empire. And as indeed many aristocrats and bankers and others felt the same way. But he was very open about it. And I think what shocked me was that he continued to hold these views, not just after his abdication, but right through to the Second World War and during the Second World War, and indeed after the Second World War, when everyone pretty much had realized that one had to stand up to Hitler and that Nazi doctrine was a pretty appalling thing. So it's these very strong sympathies for the Nazis, and indeed Wallace had them as well. She was very close to Ribbentrop, the German ambassador in London, though she, of course, denied it. But it's clear from looking at private diaries and from declassified government documents, documents in private archives, that they were much closer to the Nazis than I think people have realised. And, of course, the Nazis were courting them. They realised that they needed to get Edward on side. The great shock for the Nazis was, in fact, the fact that he abdicated, because they lost their man in the palace. Ribbentrop had in fact been sent to London to work on them because of his friendship. There were others. There was a German spy called Stephanie von Hollenhau, who was also sent to work through the society hostess Emerald Cunard. So it was quite clearly he was targeted by the Germans, and he succumbed.
Right, and if we can investigate that a little more, is it fair to say then that your book does sort of go against a perception that he was a naive target, that he was more active than has previously been laid out in terms of encouraging and working with these people?
Yes, I think the conventional view, and it's the view, for example, of Philip Ziegler in The Official Life of Edward VIII, is that he was a dupe, that he was targeted, certainly, but he was rather naive, and he perhaps used it as leverage in terms of his negotiations with his family. This is particularly true in the summer of 1940, during something called Operation Willy, when the Germans tried to recruit him as a British Petain. But I think it's... the evidence is there, and it's evidence from, for example, Alan Lassell's private diaries and from Guy Liddell, who's an MI5 officer, his diaries. And we can move on to this. But I think the evidence is that he, for example, engaged with them, he responded to them. And if we move on to Operation Willy, he knew that the Germans were in touch with him. They actually, for example, offered to take care of his possessions in his house and possessions in Paris and the south of France, and that he was dealing in code with them. And this was against the Treachery Act. I mean, he could have been not just court-martialed, he could have been tried for treason.
Yes, it's a remarkable remarkable evidence and a remarkable telegram. And all of this is detailed in your book, and it leads to this feeling that the Duke was a serious security leak. What sort of happens there with manoeuvrings on behalf of the British government and the royal family as well?
Well, there have been concerns about his indiscretion even when he was king. I mean, cabinet papers were left around. He mixed with a lot of people who were regarded as spies. And that continued, particularly there's a period when he's attached to the French forces during the Phoney War, when everyone, but from George VI and Churchill, is very concerned about his how indiscreet he is with a very close friend of his called Charles Beddoe. This is the man who lent his castle for Winston to get married. And Charles Beddoe is, in effect, a Nazi agent. And they're getting reports that Beddoe is passing this material to the German ambassador in The Hague, and it's been passed on. And these include, for example, British war plans, which has, of course, an impact on the invasion in May 1940. And the way that the British deal with this is they try and neutralise him by sending him off to the Bahamas as governor in the hope that he will be a long way away and can't engage and be this figurehead for the Germans. But what I think I do show is also during this period in the summer of 1940, when the Germans are negotiating with him about becoming this figurehead, there are all sorts of unexplained things. For example, the Germans halting when they could have destroyed the British Expeditionary Force before Dunkirk is because they're prepared to do a peace deal. And there's a lot about the peace negotiations that went on in the summer of 1940, which are linked to Edward's negotiations with the Germans. But yeah, in August 1940, he's packed off to the Bahamas, and they hope that'll be the end of him. But of course, it's not.
I wonder as well if we can just go back, as I think I skipped us ahead a little there. You mentioned he's obviously a firm supporter of a peaceful compromise rather than war. What does that mean for his views on the Germans' actions bombing England?
Well, it's this is what's so extraordinary, and we have this from the captured German documents, which were not meant to be found. They were by chance discovered by accident. But he's telling the Germans, not only does he believe in a compromised peace, in fact, he comes back to Britain in January 1940 and sees various people, including Beaverbrook, to try and campaign for a negotiated peace. That's one thing. But it's clear also that he is encouraging the Germans, saying that if you bomb them, they're more likely to come to the negotiating table. And there have even been suggestions that he basically encouraged them to bomb Buckingham Palace in September 1940, thinking that that would do the trick. So he's not just disloyal, he's actively working against his own brother.
So you mentioned he's packed off to the Bahamas, where it's felt that he will be away from the continent and unable to have the same sort of influence. How does he feel about this, and how does the Duchess of Windsor feel about this as well?
Well, they hate it. They describe it like the Elbe, and they feel they've been completely exiled, or St. Helena. I mean, they like the fact that they're quite close to the States, and that's again a concern for the British and indeed the Americans, because, of course, the Americans haven't come into the war at this point. Roosevelt has got a crucial election in November 1940. They don't want to give any succor to the isolationists, and the Windsors are very keen to get to the States, and there's a great battle to keep them away. But when they get to the Bahamas, they then are targeted by various, again, Nazi sympathisers, Nazi agents of influence, at least, a Swedish industrialist called Alex Wennergren, and indeed some American businessmen, notably a man called James Mooney. So he gets into bad company in the Bahamas as well. And he's still trying to work for a compromise peace of some sort. We think, in touch with some of these intermediaries in Portugal and elsewhere. Roosevelt is so concerned about this that he has the FBI put him under surveillance whenever he comes to the States. And I think it's pretty clear that he's been put under surveillance by the British. His detectives, even in the 1936 and 37, were reporting back to Scotland Yard and the Home Office and the Palace, indeed, on his activities and who he was seeing. He, of course, made his famous trip to Germany in October 1937 when he met Hitler. But I think all the people around him, his entourage, are actually agents for the intelligence services as well. So, and there's postal censorship. He thinks that his stuff is not being read, but I suspect it is. Certainly Wallace's mail has been read, and we can see the postal censorship reports there on her and indeed on others. So he's continuing his treacherous activities in the Bahamas, saying that he can come back at any time. And even when America comes into the war in December 1941, that still doesn't stop him intriguing against the British.
Pretty damning stuff. If I can pick up then on, it might seem a more frivolous point, I suppose, but picking up on his lifestyle, and I mean the extravagance and self-interest of their lives is pretty prevalent throughout your account. But during wartime, you know, how are they? Is there any sense that they're sort of tempering this during wartime?
No, of course not. I mean, they can't live as royals, but they try to, and of course that gets them into all sorts of problems, financial problems. But they have a huge mansion in the south of France. They have a large townhouse in Paris, which they spend a huge sums of money redecorating. When they get to the Bahamas, even though the government house has been redecorated for them, they say it's not good enough, and they would like large sums of money spent on doing it up. And they're told by the Colonial Office, well, this is the cost of a Spitfire, you know, and we can't have this. But, you know, he's insistent. Same thing, he wants to bring his valet and his piper and all sorts of people who have been called up for active service. And he just thinks that he can have exactly what he wants. So there's a bit of a tussle there. And in fact, he has a little strop and threatens to go off to Canada to his ranch unless it's done for him. And that happens all the way through. He threatens not to take up jobs if he can't get his own way. And sometimes he is given his own way just to have a quiet life. But I mean, even when they make their trips to the States, though they claim that they're doing this very modestly, they travel, the press reports, with 85 pieces of luggage, which has to be put in the hallway. There's just no room in the hotel to store it. They have a huge retinues of staff. They are given by this man, James Mooney of General Motors, a cavalcade of cars. They go and stay in the most expensive hotels. Wallace will say, well, I'm only really interested in the poor people of the Bahamas. And then she goes and buys 250 dresses at one of the largest, most expensive dress shops. So it's very clear they were extravagant and had really a completely tin ear about what was happening during the war and the deprivations that people were going through. They just continued to live their pre-war life.
Okay, there is one episode during the Duke of Windsor's governorship of the Bahamas, which you say was the making of him. What can you say about this sort of episode and how he responds?
Well, one of the developments that goes on in the Bahamas is it's used as a base, a training base, RAF training base, the Americans are brought in to build the base. That, of course, brings work for the local population and helps with the economic restoration of the island, which has always lagged behind just because of the way the government is organized. There's a resentment because the imported labor, mainly Americans, are paid at a higher daily rate than the Bahamians. And there's a riot, and he comes back from the States to deal with it, and he deals with their problems and shows that he's sympathetic and shows that actually he's quite effective. And one has to feel sorry for him because he's caught between the strictures of the colonial office and something called the Bay Street Boys, which are basically local businessmen who basically run the island and who really don't want any reform and certainly don't want to improve the position of the non-white population, which he sort of wants to do. And I would say it's also the making of Wallace, that someone who's really had nothing to do in her life suddenly has this role running charities like the Red Cross, and she runs various kitchens for the servicemen. She is very keen on dealing with the health problems, particularly of the young native population. There's a very high rate of syphilis. So she is, I think, a very dedicated charity worker there. He is slightly more aimless. I mean, there's stories of him going to strip shows and driving his car across golf courses and drinking heavily. He's not a great example, but Wallace, I think, rises to the occasion much more.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Yes, I think we should have statues to Wallace. I mean, she saved us. It's clearly been one of the most traumatic moments in royal history, recent royal history. And of course, it plays to that trope of the crown between public service and private pleasure.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
I'd really like to talk about the social life and the importance of that in their lives going forward.
Well, at the end of the Bahamas, they hate the Bahamas. They hate the climate. They find it very parochial. And they're gunning to get a job, ideally as some sort of ambassador in America, or there's discussions of sending him to South America. But there's no job for him. The government are against him. Churchill's quite in favour. But the royal family are adamant that he has these very dubious associates, most of whom have turned out to be collaborators, that he is indiscreet and, frankly, not very dedicated to public service. And so he comes back to France. The advantage of France is that he is exempt from taxation there, which is a great attraction for him. The French take very good care of him and give him special privileges and, indeed, subsidise rent and houses and things. But even the French are worried about him because of his friendships with noted collaborationists during the war. But he, and basically any decent people really want nothing to do with him. And so he has this group of empty Cathay society, and he moves half the year between the States, basically Palm Beach and Newport and New York, where he has a big apartment in Waldorf Astoria, and Paris and south of France, with other industrialists and businessmen who, in a sense, think he might be a useful person to know. And he sponges off them. They basically support his lifestyle. And he that's really what he does. But from 1945 until his death in 1972, traveling the world, going to parties, playing golf, looking at his investments, often which are a tip from inside tips from his businessman friends, dealing in black currency. Of course, there were currency restrictions still at this point. He's very active in it during his time in the Bahamas, and he continues in Paris. Indeed, there's a big scandal that's hushed up when his, and in fact, his secretary, who's responsible for all this, is sacked and paid off when he threatens to go to the papers about it. He's just a very dodgy character.
Yes. So could you take us a little more into this sort of social scene they create for themselves in the sort of the mid-century and perhaps share some of the opinions or that you surface in your account of what they were like?
Well, I mean, they were upset that their dining room only took 24 for dinner. So they had to get bigger and bigger places. They entertained probably twice a week at dinner parties, and of course were out pretty much every other night at nightclubs and restaurants and at other people's houses. They would often dictate who the guest list were at events if they were attending, or try to. They would. There are stories of them being invited to private dinners and asking what the menu is and if they can send their cook because they don't trust the cook of the house. Exploit their royal position with business ventures, rather dubious business ventures and endorsements. They are not great employers. They don't pay the going rate because they think people should feel privileged to work for them. They certainly don't treat them well. It's a very demanding job, and people often don't stay very long. They sack people for the slightest misdemeanor. But everything, in some ways, Wallace has nothing better to do than to run the household. So she keeps a very tight eye on accounts. She has what she calls her grumble book, which where she makes notes at the dinner party of what was right and wrong and went well. And they have staff dressed in their own livery. Extraordinary, extravagant meals, 8-course meals. They're rather boring company, and people, for example, Duff Cooper, the ambassador, has stories of just not wanting to go and dine with them, or certainly not wanting to sit next to them. But that's what they do, and they go on cruises. There's some wonderful stories from Rex Harrison, who met them when they were staying in Positano. Wallace is bored and begins to have affairs with young men, most notably a young gay guy called Jimmy Donahue. It's a way, I think, of getting back at the Duke, too. But they have a country house where they entertain again under a very strict formula. People have to come at a certain time. They eat at certain, you know, always at 8:45. The food they serve, I have to say, sounds pretty disgusting. Camembert ice cream and various things like that. I mean, lots of the sort of food that we no longer eat, jellied chicken and... she was criticized for her taste, which is seen as rather tacky. But they spend a fortune on jewels, on furniture, on little mice and pugs. And that's really how they get their pleasure from this life of entertaining and being entertained. There's nothing else really to fill it.
No, not much else. And it's certainly an interesting picture that builds up. If we can revisit a point then that you made at the top of the interview, that theirs is often remembered as a great love story. You've already mentioned one of Wallace's affairs in your last answer, but can we dig into that picture a little more in terms of their own dynamic, particularly in the later years?
Yeah, I mean, it's clear even just from looking at Lady Diana Cooper's diaries that Wallace, even before they got married, was bored by him and actually didn't really want to be in his company. She's now stuck with him, and she begins, as the marriage goes on, to resent it more and more. He likes the fact she's dominant, and she frankly bullies him to the point of tears on many occasions. And he's such a sort of sub that he enjoys this submissive person. This was true also his relationship with Frieda Dudley Ward. And people are shocked by how rude she is to him. Buzz off, mosquito, she says at one point. She's very open about the affair with Jimmy Donahue. I mean, there are stories of her going upstairs to have sex with Donahue when he's sitting downstairs at the dining room table with guests. And so she sort of humiliates him, which, you know, firstly he loves. But it's a very sad relationship in which he becomes ever more devoted. He can't almost not be in a room with her and is worried about where she is at any time. He relies on her for everything, to entertain him, to direct his life. And she is a very strong personality. Partly she likes this, but partly she loses any sort of respect for him. And that continues all the way through, really, to his death. I mean, the romantic stories are that he sort of died in her arms. But the fact is that we know from the nurses that even though her bedroom was a few doors away from him, she didn't see him for the last 2 weeks of his life. And he would call out for her and she would just ignore him. It's a really poignant story. Here was a man absolutely obsessed with her who'd given up everything for her, and she just treated him like dirt.
And he never stops petitioning his family for her to be recognised in a sort of a royal status. And how does that affect his relationship with his family in these many, many years after the crisis?
Well, she's never made her Royal Highness. The line is that, you know, why did we go through the abdication if she was going to be her Royal Highness? But it's very unfair that she's not made her Royal Highness. His brothers who are married, and if he was to be treated as a younger a child of the king or the younger brother, you know, she would be entitled to it. He's actually made a prince when he's born, and his wife should become her Royal Highness. So, you know, it's rather dubious legal precedent to say that she's denied it. They insisted throughout their life that everyone had to curtsy to her, and they were always at the head of the table and served first, and people couldn't leave dinner parties before they decided to leave, often very late. But all the way through, he kept coming back, talking to his brother, talking to Queen Mary. But particularly Queen Mary and Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, were adamant that they hadn't gone through the abdication for her to become Her Royal Highness. Initially, there were concerns that the marriage wouldn't last and therefore that, you know, she would hold on to this title when there might be another wife. But even when it was clear that that wasn't going to happen, they were determined that she would not be given this accolade. And it was a great source of shame for him. He felt that he should be able to provide this for his wife and he couldn't. And that was another factor in her losing respect for him. And it was the one thing that he could do for her and he failed at that. So it was a tension all the way through. And it's fascinating to see the royal correspondence. Most of course, is locked up at the Royal Archives, but things have got out, just showing how strong the royal family are all the way through in not budging an inch in terms of giving him a job or giving him any sort of status.
Right. And that picture is sort of, if there was any sort of leniency coming in later years, that picture is solidified by what's known later as the Marburg file. Could we talk about this, the find, you've already mentioned it earlier on in our interview, and what this means for him?
Yes, I think the Marburg file perhaps explains why the royal family were determined to isolate him and really to have as little to do with him as possible. It wasn't just the abdication. And the Marburg file was the discovery at the end of the war, in fact, in the Russian zone, of basically documents from the German Foreign Office, particularly showing the correspondence with Windsor before the war and also during the war, particularly in the summer of 1940 when during this Operation Willy, and showing just how open he was to the approaches from the Germans and how treacherous he was. And these documents were meant to be basically burnt. For various reasons, people, I think, thought it might be their calling card to escape. They were not burnt. They were just the tins were buried. And they were discovered and brought to the Allies. And the British realized how this was dynamite. The problem was that Americans also got copies of this material. And there's a whole section in the book, and indeed the whole post-war period is filled with the British trying to suppress this information. The Americans say this is important for the Nuremberg trials, it's important historical documents that we should be publishing them. And the British are saying, oh God, no, this is too awful. Churchill is lobbying Eisenhower and various other people to say if they can't be destroyed, and they did destroy quite a lot of them, and quite a lot of them have disappeared, but if you are going to do something, then let's try and delay it as long as possible. And that's what they do. They kick this into touch really until the late 1950s. But they are published in 1957, and it's pretty clear this confirms his involvement with the Nazis. And it's also very clear when you look at things like Guy Diddell's diary and Alan Lascelles' diary, that they're not going through the motions. They're absolutely panicking about this. They confirm that, you know, this is not just the Germans making it up. This is absolutely true. This is how he behaved. So that's a huge thing that hangs over him. Some of the telegrams remain closed and disappeared. The account of the meeting with Hitler in October 1937 has disappeared. So I suspect there's a lot more that we'll just never know about because they were destroyed or have still to be found. But this Marburg farce certainly hung over him. And it's a pretty damning indictment of Churchill that he was prepared to censor our history in this way. And others like Eisenhower were sort of half prepared to go along with him. And it was only the intransigence of the American historians who said, look, we're going to go public with this if you try and suppress it, that the story will be bigger than if we just publish it. But it was clear even when they came out, there were statements made saying this is all rubbish and this is all made up by the Germans, and the Duke was entirely loyal and there, for example, didn't circulate it widely. The publisher, there was pressure put on the publisher. There was clearly no real press release that went out, and there were very tame articles supporting the Duke put out by chums. So the whole thing they tried to suppress.
What about then? This comes later, I think. But what about the Duke and Duchess of Windsor's own framing of their narrative? What attempts did they take in forms of memoirs and interviews, etc.?
Well, it's very interesting. They tried to shape the narrative from very early on. I mean, they had a man called Newbold Noyes who came and interviewed them, but even before the abdication. And then when he wrote his piece, they didn't like it, having given him sort of an office in Buckingham Palace and tried to sue him. They used a Nazi-supporting lawyer to do so. All the way through, there were attempts to work with authors like Compton Mackenzie, Robert Bruce Lockhart, Philip Guadella, and to trash anyone who tried to write anything that was independent. They were constantly suing people. There was a man who wrote a book called Coronation Commentary called Geoffrey Dennis. And that was their way. They tried to dissuade people from writing stories. But of course, there was also this great divide between public opinion in Britain and in the States, where, of course, they were much more popular. And so they did interviews with people for television and in print, most notably a series of articles in 1966 where they talked about the period after the abdication and were pretty disparaging about their family. Then, of course, they had these two autobiographies, his book, A King's Story, published in 1951, and hers, The Heart Has Its Reasons, in 1956, both ghosted by the same man. They'd gone through several ghostwriters who gave up because they wouldn't give the attention to the books, and they were telling them such a pack of lies that they just couldn't, for their own reputations, be associated with them. But eventually this man, Charles Murphy, got these books out of them. And they're quite interesting accounts. They sold quite well. But they were pretty deceitful, and they, in fact, didn't even correspond, the facts in the two books. And were largely ignored, hardly reviewed, and so are interesting period pieces. but they certainly, you know, cooperated with people who would shape the narrative that they wanted, and were very careful who they gave interviews to. They had a series of articles. She had a series of articles, something called McCall's Magazine, where she just put her own views out and again tried to create a separate, different narrative. And at that time, of course, the royal family didn't really respond to anything. They did, certainly didn't publish anything or cooperate with tame journalists in the same way as they do now. And so in some ways, an alternative narrative was allowed to be constructed, including the great love story of the century.
Yes. Well, this narrative notwithstanding, your book, you know, has lots of evidence of actions, views and character that paint a different picture. And, you know, there's much more evidence in the book that we haven't discussed today. But is there is it fair to say that the line in your book is that ultimately this abdication, it's a good thing for the monarchy? It's the best outcome there.
Yes, I think we should have statues to Wallace. I mean, she saved us. It's clearly been one of the most traumatic moments in royal history, recent royal history. And of course, it plays to that trope of the crown between public service and private pleasure. But, you know, I think Bertie proved to be a much better king than he would have been. And indeed, Queen Elizabeth, a much better queen. She would have come to reign, probably, eventually. But given that the Duke of Windsor didn't die until 1972, she might not have come to the throne until at least 20 years later. So a very different story might have emerged. And if he'd been there, you know, would he have, for example, done some deal during the war with the Germans? If he hadn't married Wallace also, there's lots of counterfactual, interesting sort of things to explore. But if he hadn't met Wallace and had married Frieda Dudley Ward or someone, would history have been very different, and would he have been a much more respected figure?
Indeed, it's a compelling question, and I hope that I do encourage our listeners to read more and find out more in your book. And I'll say again, it's Traitor King, The Duke and Duchess of Windsor in Exile. It's published by Blink Publishing and it's out now. And Andrew, thank you so much for your time in talking to us about The Duke and Duchess of Windsor today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That was Andrew Lowney. As Eleanor mentioned, his book Traitor King is on sale now, and you can find a link in the show notes. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. Tomorrow we have an Everything You Wanted to Know episode on the history of the British police.